Spin that P45, it's time for another flat chat. And not only is the latest issue of GP Racing on the shelves, we've actually managed to assemble the troops to record a podcast in good time this month rather than a couple of weeks too late. On the cover, we mark Sebastian Vettel's retirement with a triptych of features covering his eventful journey through Formula One. In other retirement stroke P45 news, there's been a Tim Principal merry-go-round in progress over the past 24 hours or so. The 2022 Formula One season might be over, but the news never stops. Joining me to chew over this well-stuffed pre-Christmas turkey and chilling out with a glass of wine in the desert cold of South Australia, it's Mark Gallagher.
Nice to join you for what they call a fast-moving environment today, isn't it, with constant breaking news from teams about who's going to be running their team next year.
This podcast is going to be irrelevant by the time we finish recording it, let alone by the time poor old Martin's finished editing it. But let's move over to someone else who's chilled to the bone in the freezing cold Midlands, having recently moved from the even more frozen north. It's Matt Q.
Hi, Collis. Yeah, I've swapped the fog on the Tyne for, as I look out the window, the fog on the Blackstones Football Club pitch in the local community. So that's all right. But it's a pretty bleak day. I've got to drive back up north later this afternoon to clear out or to clean the property so I can get some of my deposit back from the evil landlords and estate agents.
Foul, money-grubbing, capitalist swine.
Absolutely. So if I can get through the fog there and back, then it's all good. Plain sailing from here on until Christmas, I hope.
As many GP racing readers will be aware, one of the world's most famous triptychs is, of course, the Heywayne triptych, painted by Hieronymus Bosch around 1516, latterly owned by King Philip II of Spain. Perhaps one day our thematically linked trio of features in this month's issue will be regarded as similarly historically significant. We present it on the cover as The Many Faces of Sebastian Vettel because, well, he's been many things to many people during his time in Formula One. The cheeky young hot shoe who liked to quote Monty Python and Little Britain, not that he can do that now without being cancelled, and remains the youngest driver to win the world championship. The utterly dominant winner of four consecutive world championships, the thoroughly evil rotter who disobeyed team orders to win a race at his teammates' expense, the sensitive soul who cracked under pressure of trying to emulate his hero, and most recently, the social justice warrior who retired because he couldn't face polluting the planet anymore or visiting any further despotic regimes. Well, it's been an interesting life in Formula One for Sebastian Vettel, but for one thing, it's bizarre to me that for all his success, the German public never took to him as they did to Michael Schumacher. Now, Mark, you were very much around during Michael Schumacher's pomp. You were sort of you were there when he first drove a Formula One car. So, what to you are the main differences between them?
I think the obvious difference was that by the time Vettel came along, it had all been done by Michael. He'd been there, he'd won the world championship, not just once or twice, but seven times. And the German fans, the domestic fans, had truly fallen in love with Michael. You know, Formula One just accelerated for a 15-year period, starting in 91 with his debut at Jordan, and then through the Benetton years, and those that decade effectively at Ferrari, over a decade at Ferrari. It was a 15-year period, so it defined a whole generation, and it really made Formula One a big sport for a couple of generation of German sports fans. And I think when Michael left after 2006, I mean, interest in Formula One definitely waned in Germany. And Vettel, when he came in with Red Bull, didn't somehow capture that, didn't recapture what Michael had had. And even when Michael came back, I mean, the domestic fans could see that he was a shadow of his former self. I do quite a lot of work in Germany. I've done a lot of work over the years. And I would quite often ask people in audiences at events that I'd be speaking at, you know, so why do you not, you know, get behind Sebastian as much? And they would come up with a kind of a narrative around the fact that Michael had come up the hard way, and you know, there's the old stories of, you know, his dad getting used car tires off other teams so that Michael could go and win races with used tires and all that kind of stuff. You know, they kind of, it was a bit of the hard luck story, and then this sort of breaking fresh ground that he did, and all of those firsts, literally all of those firsts that he achieved in terms of his successes. So Sebastian was seen as being part of a very corporate sort of academy, you know, the Red Bull thing, the BMW thing, you know, easing his way through into Formula One. It all seemed incredibly polished and easy, whereas with Michael, it was a bit more rough and ready. You know, Willy Weber managing to win the German F3 championship with Willy's team, and then cobbling together a sports car drive, and then paying Eddie Jordan for his debut. It was all a little bit different and perhaps a little bit more romantic. Whereas with Sebastian, it was very corporate. At least that's how it looked. And the really interesting thing I find is that here we are at the end of Sebastian's career, and it's like the whole world of Formula One has fallen in love with the guy in recent years. You know, media have fallen in love with him in a way that they didn't during his halcyon days at Red Bull Racing. I think the transition began at Ferrari. I think the fact, and actually now when we go back and look at what he did at Ferrari against the oh-so-dominant Mercedes team, you know, there's perhaps a reappraisal of just how good he was at that time. And then there's no question, you know, this final period of his career where he didn't retire, he decided to go to Aston Martin. And I think possibly thanks in no small part to the efforts of our former colleague at Grand Prix Racing, Matt Bishop, you know, as director of communications at Aston Martin. He helped Sebastian to communicate himself and his enthusiasms and his passions in a way that had never quite been done before. There was the appearance of BBC Question Time. There was the litter picking at the British Grand Prix last year. There's lots of moments which made people reappraise Sebastian. And then I think also for all of us who are, you know, massive racing fans, an awareness over time that here was a guy who just loved motor racing, and he loved cars, and he loved motorcycles, and he liked working on cars and motorcycles, and he knows the history of the sport very well. And, you know, there was that nice little video recently that went viral where he was asked to list every Formula One world champion since 1950, and he went and he did it, and it looked authentic. And I mean, lots of us could work our way through the championship titles, but it was good to see Sebastian do that, because it made you realise he has a sense of his place in the world of Formula One. So, yeah, different era in so many ways from the Schumi era, but it's nice to see that there's been a reappraisal of Sebastian, and I think he doesn't leave the sport with anything other than a very nice legacy and a great reputation.
Matt, what's your perspective on Seb? Because you obviously will have been but a pimply youth in short trousers when he made his Formula One debut and went on to become a four-time world champion. But you've sort of met him and had dealings with him more recently. You probably have a very different perspective on him.
I suppose that I was a fan when he was in his pomp, a fan of motorsport rather than working in motorsport when he was in his pomp. So, you know, a few things that certainly stand out is I think when he spun against the wall in Hungary in 2013, like the massive cheers, and so and again when he did similar, I think coming out of the final corner at Silverstone, the huge reception that got from the British crowd. Like, he may not have been massive in quite the same way as Michael Schumacher with his own country, but certainly he was still very much the enemy for sort of an Anglo audience, you know, him against Hamilton or Button during that time. And I think just talking about his reception in Germany, the fact that it was basically not on his watch, but certainly during his time in Formula One, the German Grand Prix at both Hockenheim and the Nürburgring fell off the calendar and is showing no signs of returning. The fact that that wasn't enough to sort of pack out the grandstands, and yeah, you can perhaps attribute that some of that to, you know, pseudo Finn living in Monaco, Nico Rosberg as well, but it nevertheless happened during Vettel's tenure. But I sort of divulge a bit of information. Whenever he was doing the FIA press conferences, this is my first full season working in F1, I text my Autosport colleague Luke Switch, just going, God, what this guy says just makes sense. You know, the fact that still now our Home Secretary is someone that he utterly humiliated on Question Time by being more coherent and articulate than her is something that's not lost or shouldn't be lost on
a low wattage politico. I believe the author of the feature in GP Racing described that in
quite, but he's brilliant. And again, like, so we're speaking not too long after the Autosport Awards, and because I'm much younger than you, Codders, I had the vim and the energy to stay to the after party. I know you were nicely tucked up in bed by then with your Horlicks or whatever you do. But then, like, he was, you know, he was posing for everyone's photos and it was great, but he spent most of his time with our dear friend Alan Hyde, who they knew each other from Formula BMW days. So, you know, what a bloke, you know, still remembering the guy and having those chats. And it actually, sorry, I'm jumping all over the place, but I was doing some research for a piece I was writing on Max Verstappen earlier in the year about how he won at Monza and how that compared to some of Vettel's best work. And I was reading some articles from 2010, and although, yes, the public perception was bad, certainly the journalists spoke so highly of him that he was insanely affable all the way through. So I think as Mark said, it was about teasing that out to the wider world rather than it being sort of a reinvention of Vettel. I think, you know, you like to believe that he was that great bloke all along, but certainly he's not massively generous with his media time, but I think that's part of the deal his team probably negotiated with Aston Martin, is that, you know, they don't do endless one-on-ones. It's more about, you know, visiting the young offenders, and also doing magazine covers with Aramco logos on. I think that's more sort of how they wanted to use their time in the press. But yeah, always sensible to deal with. You knew you were going to get an intelligent and articulate answer. Yeah, so enjoyable, and even if I didn't see him quite in his prime, it would be nice to say sort of one day that, yeah, I at least interacted with him a little bit.
I think he found the questions from the press a little bit kind of boring, and Nico Hülkenberg is a little bit the same, and there are times he doesn't really want to talk about motor racing particularly, or wants to talk about the minutiae with it. I think partly it's because he worked so hard behind the scenes, you know, just kind of as Matt Ewson teased out in the first part of our triptych, he was the man of many long debriefs and worked very diligently behind the scenes on the detail of making his car quick. So he didn't want to go from there to then sort of have to deal with possibly less informed questions from the media in some cases.
He even did a standard length Vettel debrief after Abu Dhabi, bearing in mind he'll probably never drive an active F1 car again. Well, I say active, he might drive his 1992 FW14B, but in terms of a contemporary Formula 1 car, the fact he still sort of delayed his appearance at his own after party by a couple of hours, you know, in Premier League football, you never go through all your mistakes of the last game of the season. That's a write-off, but he's went through the last race of his career.
Is it always been a very good hurdle? And the other thing that comes out from Matt's piece is that there's no one has a bad word to say about him in the Red Bull organisation. You know, the people who shifted his pedals to put in the right place remember him as a very nice person who texted them, was the first to text them to congratulate them on winning the world championship, and always sends them Christmas cards and their wives Christmas cards and that sort of thing. And even when it came down to discussing the infamous multi-21 gate, which, you know, we should discuss, no one within the team was prepared to say anything negative about him. And I think Jonathan Wheatley says, you know, that's just the ruthlessness of a successful racing driver. I suppose, you know, a successful racing driver has to have that ruthlessness. If they say, oh well, after you, mate, they're not going to be a world champion.
The multi-21 thing was interesting to see unfold, and my take on it was that he was having a moment where he was thinking, what would Michael have done in this situation? And as a student of Schumacher, he would have realised there was no way Michael was going to let anyone else win in the team unless he decided it himself. And Sebastian wasn't about to do that. And I think that was possibly less a reflection of Sebastian's ruthlessness than the fact that he made a conscious decision to emulate someone who he really looked up to. And he paid a heavy price for it, possibly because so many people knew that it was slightly untypical of him as a person, as a driver, as a character within the sport. You know, the media gave him a hard time. You know, Weber gave him a hard time. Obviously, lots of people were kind of surprised at that. You wouldn't have been surprised if a Senna or a Schumacher had done it. So, but there was a surprise that a Vettel had done it. And I took that as a kind of a carefully curated moment in his career where he's driving the car, thinking, you know, I'm sorry, I'm not going to do this. I'm not, you know, I'm here to win, and whatever the deal is, whatever the agreement is, I'm not going to toe the line and let Mark, you know, score a victory. Because I think there's always a niggle in the back of teammates' minds that the moment you move over, the moment you give away, it could become the thin end of the wedge, and they're all desperately frightened of losing their position within the team, and that was it. And so it was such an interesting moment. I mean, social media hadn't quite become the giant toxic nightmare that it is today, but it was in its infancy, and it still caused one hell of a stir online. Multi-21
also on the cover of our magazine. We slightly mischievously, and at risk of a colossal lawsuit from the Walt Disney Organization, had a portrait of Darth Vader on the cover, with Seb's face being the other half. And we didn't get sued by Lucasfilm or the Disney Corporation, but we did get quite a lot of heat from Christian Horner and the Red Bull media organisation. However, that was a few years ago, and we're now several Red Bull heads of media down the line, because they seem to change almost as often as Formula One team principals. Anyway, moving on to the Ferrari years, it's interesting in Roberto Quinquero's piece, he brings out a lot more of Seb's temperament being... Everyone's saying that he's kind of more Latin in his temperament than you might think the stereotypical German personality would be, that he's sort of quite a sensitive soul, and that a lot of the mistakes he made towards the end of his tenure were caused by him panicking and being put under pressure to succeed now, because he knew that his position was increasingly under threat from Charles Leclerc.
I wonder if it's at all time to reevaluate the sort of multi-21 saga, just in light of recent events, because that was the second race of the season for victory, when Vettel certainly had a lot more pace than his teammate that day, as opposed to, let's say, Interlagos 9 years later, where it's a fight for sixth and seventh place, when one driver's already wrapped up the championship and it's critical to his teammate getting runner-up in the standings, which he ultimately didn't do. So I just wonder whether Vettel sort of for all the was at that time, whether his like sort of misdemeanor or his disobedience was slightly less egregious than perhaps Verstappen's was at Interlagos. I thought it was actually really interesting to compare the Red Bull and the Ferrari pieces themselves. Matt Eusen does a fantastic job, obviously, you know, spoken to so many people in the paddock to really sort of tease out elements of Vettel's character. And then we know Roberto sort of how well established he is, particularly in sort of Ferrari circles, and that his piece was much more a lot of off the record informational bits you might not have known that he was bringing to light, and I really enjoyed the contrast there. But talk about his temperament, sort of I know Codders, with your poultry word counts, there's only so much you can include, but you know, you think to Baku when he pulled alongside Hamilton, and although I think it's still put down to like a mistake or lapse in concentration, he never left Biff the side pod of the Mercedes, and certain moments like that. So if you thought sort of during the blown diffuser, wins in a row, metronoric championships, that he was almost sort of robotic, you know, any like German stereotype you can throw at Vettel. Certainly, he did have a more fiery temperament that came out. You know, the bit Roberto writes in that story that, you know, for half a day or whatever, a couple of hours, he wouldn't surface from his sort of private quarters before facing the media, because he really took it to heart, and probably to a fault, like you say, when you know, if 2017 is a championship lost to Ferrari's shortcomings, and 2018 is largely attributed to Vettel, and as Roberto said, that says the sort of correlation between Leclerc being signed and then Vettel sort of making all the whoopsies along the way is, you know, it's probably correlation rather than causation, or perhaps rather than causation, but certainly overlaps. So I suggest, yeah, he is an emotional guy, but perhaps we're seeing the fruits of that now, that he wouldn't be so invested in sort of certain campaigns in his environmental action and whatever if he wasn't so emotional. So it might not have made him a fifth or sixth time world champion to, you know, build the Ferrari super team that he originally envisaged, but I suppose we should be thankful for it, because he's not disappeared into obscurity or anything. He's used that sort of those emotions, which is in no way to be construed as a weakness, but he's used them for good, I suppose, in a way that Vader never did.
If memory serves, at the end of Return of the Jedi, Vader did sort of have a little bit of a Road to Damascus conversion, or was it a Road to Endor conversion? I don't know. One of the above. The third part of our triptych, we dig into Sebastian's eco-activism. I guess it was always going to be pretty hard for a team owner like Lawrence Stroll to swallow having a high-paid driver dissing all sorts of things, including gas guzzling, when one of the major sponsors of the team, particularly in 2022, is Aramco, responsible for a lot of the greatest share of CO2 emissions historically over the past couple of decades. That must have sat slightly ill with Seb, having that sort of organisation emblazoned on his chest and also having to PR it.
Yeah, and I think that was one of the interesting points about his appearance on BBC Question Time, when Fiona Bruce put it to him about the potential hypocrisy of talking about saving the world and from the effects of human-made global warming, and the fact he drives a Formula One car. And he said, "You're right. It's something I think about all the time." And that came across so refreshingly, that there was somebody in BBC Question Time who actually thinks with a conscience about what they're actually doing. And it was certainly in stark contrast to the wonderful Suella Braverman and the general shouting match that she and the professional politicians went into. So Sebastian has this deep thought process going on about his life, his place in the world, his place in Formula One, Formula One's place in the world. I'm so interested to see what he goes on to do as a result, because there's so much that a guy like that could choose to do. He's made more money than he will ever need. He can invest it in lots of different interesting ways. If I was Stefano Domenicali and thinking about what Formula One's attempting to do with its much promoted 2030 net zero carbon program, I'd be talking to Sebastian about, you know, how would he like to get involved in that? And I think, you know, coming back to your point, Codders, there is this really significant issue that whilst the press releases from the teams and from Formula One and the FIA about climate change and how Formula One's going to play its role in helping the environment and in developing solutions that have a broader benefit to society, the fact is that companies like Aramco and Shell and BP are heavily involved in the sport. And I talk in my column this month about sport washing and, you know, the FTX cryptocurrency scandal. And that's something that Formula One has to be very careful about in terms of its partnerships with companies that certainly at the moment remain profoundly wedded to the extraction of fossil fuels and the burning of fossil fuels. And it's hard to see, in the case of Aramco in particular, that changing in any meaningful way in the next 7 years. So Sebastian represents a consciousness amongst the driving community in Formula One that maybe we haven't seen, certainly not in relation to this topic. And there's one other important point as well, which is I think that, you know, in these Aston Martin years, his very public support for the campaigning that Lewis Hamilton has been doing around equality, around diversity, around gay rights, around the Black Lives Matter movement, taking the knee, pre-race events to promote to the agendas that are so important to Lewis, and how that has impacted in Formula One. Because when you take 4 times world champion Sebastian Vettel and 7 times world champion Lewis Hamilton, and you say, well, so here's 11 championship titles since 2010, and these two guys appear to be properly friendly, joined at the hip in terms of the things that they're passionate about and speaking out about, and that they formed a very interesting duet, I think, when it came to promoting these causes. So it's been very interesting to watch. And whilst I think it's very clear that Sebastian probably knew he should have retired at the end of his Ferrari time, he wanted to have one last hurrah, and obviously got well paid for that last hurrah too, and going to Aston Martin, and that was fine. I viewed it a bit like the Irvine Jaguar years. You know, you come out of Ferrari, you don't want to hang up your helmet just yet. You've made your proper money, you've had your proper chance, and you've got a British sports car manufacturer waving a large checkbook in your face saying, come and drive for us. You know you're not going to win anything, but, well, let's have a bit of fun. And I think he's had a lot of fun the last couple of years.
At least Lawrence Stroll knew who Sebastian Vettel was, unlike, you know, was it William Clay Ford Jr.?
Yeah, sure.
Who the hell is Ed Irvine? Yeah.
Indeed, Bill Ford.
Let's move on to a driver who, so far as I know, has not assisted in the construction of a B hotel. Pierre Gasly has been speaking to Oleg. Oleg has also spoken to Pierre Gasly's new boss, Otmar Szafnauer, one of the longest-serving team principals on the F1 grid, as we speak. It's
brackets,
interesting to hear...
Brackets, not difficult. That's not a difficult thing to do anymore. I mean, Gunther Steiner is now one of the longest-serving team principals in Formula One.
Returning briefly to Pierre Gasly, Otmar Szafnauer, Pierre opens up in this issue about his reasons for pulling the ripcord and leaving the Red Bull family, which were interesting because it represents a tacit acknowledgement on his part that he was never going to get back into the senior team. And for his part, he is adamant that his best achievements are yet to come. He's going to build on the Grand Prix victory that he's taken. The question is, does the panel agree with him?
I suppose you could cite Hamilton, and I think 30 of his 103 wins came before his 30th birthday. So his latter years certainly the most successful, most prosperous. Is that going to happen with Pierre Gasly? Probably not, because if he was that level of talent, then obviously he would have been banging on the door to Red Bull so hard that he would have either returned to the team or not been dropped by them in the first place. But he could obviously luck in is perhaps a wrong turn of phrase. Do I see Alpine being as high up as Mercedes and Red Bull during this next rule cycle? No. So therefore, you're relying on 4 cars to hit some sort of trouble over the weekend for Pierre Gasly to be in position to pounce. So I suppose you'd have to say it's somewhat fortunate if he got there. But I think he's a good driver. If Alpine were insistent that they were never going to reunite with Daniel Ricciardo, he was the best in sort of underlined and in italics available or realistic driver to hire, I think, in the circumstances. Actually, I thought, just having spoken about Vettel, I thought it was really interesting. The two bits that stood out to me is that the first quote Oleg has of Pierre Gasly is talks about him taking a video for his social media accounts and then saying why Helmut Marko wanted him to stay because he was a good fit, because he's into fashion, so he'd have been good for AlphaTauri. I thought, it's a bit different there to maybe Vettel appearing on the cover of Attitude magazine while sponsored by Aramco and potentially not being too upset to miss the Saudi Arabian Grand Prix, his sponsor's home race. But anyway, Gasly's good value. I think a bit like his teammate, really, Esteban Ocon, who is new team at Alpine, it's this next 2 years that will define how he's remembered. He talks about, you know, not needing to worry about his Formula One legacy just yet. But in the same way that Ocon will be remembered as, you know, well, there's still a question mark about whether he can be a team leader. What can he do now? He's out of Alonso's shadow, etc., 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 having not been quite the great talent to lead Mercedes lineup like he was a few years ago when he was taken on board by Toto Wolff. The same thing will be said of Pierre Gasly. What can he do now he's flown the Red Bull nest? And I think his stock's certainly fallen a little bit because once the Alpine rumours came to the fore, his head was gone at the end of last season. He was complaining, he was off the pace. He's got a little bit of rebuilding to do in of itself before you underline it with you know, suppose, or the, as much as they insist that the relationship between Ocon and Gasly is healed, I don't think it would take much for, particularly if sort of McLaren's off the boil with Oscar Piastri getting up to speed and a new team and a new team principal. If it's just the Alpine drivers infighting, then it won't take much for a few stress fractures to appear there and for that relationship to degenerate. But I think if you're, you know, everyone likes sort of a mark out of 10 or a star rating or whatever, but I'd say Pierre Gasly is probably like a B level driver in this rather than an A star like Verstappen is. But that's nothing to be. I'm sure that'll have irk some people that can be so sort of flippant and brush it off like that, but I think still nothing to be sniffed at. A good driver with a race win.
So Mark, is there anything you can do to avert another one star review for this podcast based on Matt Hughes flippancy?
I'm really excited about Gasly going to Alpine. I think he's a driver who, as we all know, he had that demotion which looked pretty terminal, and then actually had a resurgence and was a lot happier in a less pressured environment. Red Bull have obviously decided he wasn't destined for the big team and great things. And it's good that Helmut Marko eventually let him go off to do his thing. Although within the interview, there's that sort of interesting story about the fact that Marko wanted to do a deal based on Colton Herta to come into the team. And I mean, it all sounded incredibly complicated and decidedly Marco-ish in terms of what he was trying to make happen. But it's great that he's there. And plus, I'm an Alpine fan, and I think it's exciting to see a couple of French guys driving for Alpine. It kind of somehow plays to my love of the history of the sport. And, you know, it's great to have these two French guys on a purely partisan view. I hope he thrashes Ocon. I'm looking forward to seeing that. I think it's going to be really interesting, and I hope that he helps the team to move forward in a positive way. I think it'll be interesting, you know, after the Alonso era, relatively short era, but nevertheless, after the Alonso era, it'll be interesting to see what kind of dynamic Pierre brings to the team. I would think a lot more. Safnair must look back now on the debacle of the driver signings and feel like he's had a pretty good outcome at the end. I remain slightly concerned about the future for Alpine in Formula One long term, particularly once we get to the 2026 regulations. I just have a feeling, you know, at some point Luca de Meo turns around and says, look, if we're not going to get into the top three in Formula One anytime soon, you know, can we really keep on investing what we're investing in this? And it'll be interesting to see, particularly as Alpine as a car brand tries to achieve its targets in terms of the range of models and the sales and the volumes that they're trying to hit. So that makes me feel like the next couple of years are really quite important, and it'll be good to see Pierre Gasly there and playing a role in it. Did you say that Is it right that he says in the interview that he feels he's only 15% of his career over?
Yes, to that effect. More or less. Yes.
Yeah. Well, I worked that out. So that means that he's planning to do 720 Grand Prix, which means that
maths not his strong point. Clearly.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, he's on an average. If you work it out based on the championship calendar, he's planning to race for 31 seasons, which is a pretty long time. But I mean, he's saying all the right things. And his best days are in front of him, and all of that good stuff. Why should he not say that? He's not an old bloke, and he feels he's got a few good years in him yet. And let's see what he does with it. But I like how he comes across. I like his personality. I like his style. I think he's benefited enormously from the Red Bull years, and ultimately he's come out of that with a great opportunity to make his mark at Alpine. What that mark will be, I mean, ultimately is down to what Enstone can produce from their corridors.
Two French drivers in a French team. Hopefully it will be a little bit more fruitful than Eric Bernard and Eric Comas. Did they share a berth at Ligier back in the day?
Two very fine men and great drivers, but unfortunately the team wasn't in the best state at that time.
I'd met Eric Comas in sports car racing, where he was driving a Ferrari 333 SP, if memory serves. Lovely chap. Had a big shunt at Sears Point.
He had a couple of big shunts in Formula One as well, notably the one I think was in Spa, wasn't it, where Ayrton Senna went to his aid. Weirdly, I chat to Eric Comas now and again on Instagram because he rallies a Lancia Stratos in historic rallying in Europe. Yeah, and he actually owns an Instagram account, which is just Lancia Stratos. And so I messaged him, and we have a chat about. So we both share a love of Alpines. He started rallying an Alpine in an old A110 in historic rallies, and then he progressed from that to Stratos. And I keep saying to him that for my column in Grand Prix Racing magazine, I'd really like to do a column about what it's like to do a classic rally in a Lancia Stratos. I don't know how we would fit that in. But anyway, I'm working on it. I really feel like he needs an Irish co-driver for and developed in the French Alps.
I'm tempted to suspend all the laws of rigour and permit that on the very tenuous Formula One connection, because that is utterly, utterly fabulous. You know, is there any more evocative name in road cars than Stratos?
And Stratos, exactly. Yeah, I mean, really, we need a back-to-back between Alexander Wurz and Eric Comas in their Lancia Stratos. Or is it Strati?
Strati, I'm not sure. We need to go back and see whether the etymology is Greek or Latin.
Wurz would have a hard time folding himself into a Stratos, surely.
Oh my goodness, no. I mean, he's got his dad's European rallycross winning Stratos and has lots of fun in it. There's a feature waiting to be done. I don't know which magazine, but it's probably not ours.
Well, I don't know. There's, because Alex is still active in the GPDA, there's some rigor there. There's some very thin rigor there. Alex is famously fascinated by the fact that I have a wormery in my garage.
You have a wormery. You've never mentioned this on the podcast before.
We recycle. We organically recycle most of our food waste into a wormery, which Alex Wurz is fascinated by.
Okay. Does he personally come to your wormery to check it out, or?
But he always asks me about the wormery, which he spells W O R M I E as if it's some sort of reverie.
The things we end up talking about on this podcast. Well, there's a new one, the wormery. Okay, one day I hope to see the wormery in action.
I'll take a picture, but it's a load of sort of earthy stuff with some worms swimming around in it and a bit of banana peel and
you've definitely opened a can of worms there.
Speaking about things imminently landing, yeah, just before this issue went to press, we got the news that Matteo Binotto was stepping down as Ferrari team principal and will clear his desk at the end of the month if he hasn't done so already. There is a column by Matt Q on the subject at the back of that issue. And of course, as is always the way in such things, in the interregnum between this issue landing on subscribers' doormats and arriving on the newsstands, Williams decided at 4:35 p.m. on a bitterly cold Monday afternoon that it was a good time to announce the departure of team principal Jost Capito and technical director FX Murder by Illusion, as I already always call him. Fans of 1980s genre films will get that reference. Other people will wonder what on earth I'm talking about. As we record this, their replacements are expected to be announced in the new year, or in Williams speak, in due course. Always fascinating, because if, as we suspect, these departures come as a result from pressure further up the food chain, you would expect their successors have already been chosen, which brings us neatly to the subject of the merry-go-round, because we have, just before we began recording this podcast, been digesting the news that Fred Vasseur is moving from Sauber to Ferrari as team principal. Andreas Seidel is going to become the CEO of Sauber Group. So that's perhaps not a direct like-for-like replacement. There is some speculation that someone else might slot in as team principal. And longtime sporting director Andrea Stella, formerly Fernando Alonso's race engineer, will take over from Andreas Seidel as McLaren team principal. Now, the fact that all these announcements were very much coordinated and done within the hour reminds me of the board game Diplomacy, which some listeners will be familiar with, where players submit all their moves in writing and the moves are then resolved simultaneously. Always great when playing Diplomacy, makes for a busy morning when you're running a news website. So how do we comprehend the moves? Who moved first? Do we think Ferrari had Fred Vasseur on the hook when Matteo Binotto handed in his notice, etc., etc.? Let's go.
Well, certainly read that way. If you read the Italian press, it was in the offing for some time, and I think it all goes back to, in my view, to the Friday of the Italian Grand Prix when John Elkann, the chairman of Ferrari, gave an interview in Gazzetta dello Sport, or maybe it was Corriere della Sera, and he basically criticised the team, criticised the mechanics, criticised the engineers, and criticised Matteo Binotto, and said everyone is under scrutiny. And I thought, well, that's a really good way to, you know, pep up the team going into their home Grand Prix weekend, tell them that they're all being watched like a hawk, and that you might be out of a job come Monday. So It felt, once again, that Ferrari just cannot help but have this culture where there's finger pointing and people have to take credit and people have to take blame, and it's just part of the culture. I mean, what the, you know, before we recorded the podcast today, I was talking to a company online. We're doing an event for a few hundred staff, and one of the questions I got was, you know, why did Ferrari just keep underperforming? What is it about the Ferrari culture? And we ended up having a discussion about this. So, you know, I think Binotto has seen the writing on the wall, and who knows what the detail ultimately is, but, you know, he apparently resigned and he probably felt he had to resign, and maybe he had no choice. Maybe he was made an offer he couldn't refuse and he had to go. So it seems to have been on the cards for some time. Interesting to go back through the social media and the press release feeds for Ferrari. It turns out that, you know, the moment they tell you you're absolutely safe and they deny all press speculation, that's absolutely guaranteed that that's what's going to happen. It's the football team's team owner's vote of confidence in the team manager. It's almost a sure sign that they'll be gone within a couple of weeks. And so it's proven, you know. So I feel very sorry for Matteo Binotto. I think he did a good job in getting the team back to where it was this year. The operational and strategic and technical issues were clear. There was reliability problems. There were strategy issues. There was confusion at times. There were one or two, frankly, just embarrassing moments that should never be happening in a top Formula One team. But they had a fast car. They got lots of pole positions. They they'd certainly climbed back out of the rut that they got themselves into with that exploration of the fuel rules, which got them into trouble with the FIA and ended up in that rather, I think, shameful private deal that was done. He climbed back out of it. I think there's a point that I really want to make here about all of these team principle changes. You know, I've written about it in a column before. We're now way out of the era of team principals who are team owners. Only Toto owns a shareholding. He owns a third of Mercedes. Everyone else is under contract, is effectively an employee. But actually, when you go deeper than that, I'd go as far as to say that my view today is that there are four, possibly five team principals in Formula One, and that the other five are managers. They're Formula One team managers. And what defines a team principal? It's a team principal is someone who has the authority and the gravitas to make the really big calls. And I'm not talking about, you know, how many trucks you lease or how many people fly business class. I'm talking about the really big strategic decisions for the company. And I don't see that half of the so-called team principals in Formula One today have that position. They are essentially managing the racing program for the team. And it's a really interesting departure that's developed. And it is suiting the shareholders, it's suiting the team owners to create that structure where a Lawrence Stroll or a Rousing in the case of Sauber or a John Elkann in the case of Ferrari says, oh, well, actually, we'll have this chap, you know, run our team for the next, you know, couple of years and see how they get on. And it's become a big game of chess, moving these people around. And I think it's a pity. And it actually helps teams like Mercedes and Red Bull to sustain their hegemony over the sport, because they've got stability in their ownership, they've stability in their leadership. That's a very powerful thing. And I mean, Toto Wolff and Christian Horner must be looking at all of the press releases coming out today and saying, oh, well, you know, good for us. All these teams, they're trying to reinvent themselves by changing leadership and moving people around. And I think therefore we're well into this new era where periodically team principals move around, and it remains to be seen whether it's the right thing to do. I personally don't think it is. I think the structure of the teams needs to be looked at, because I'm afraid to say, I don't want to name any specific names, but I look at some of the people who are now becoming, you know, so-called team principals, and, you know, frankly, I don't ever see them delivering championship winning success. And what is your ambition as an organization in Formula One if it's not to one day win the Formula One championship? If you just want to participate as a team, well, you know, anybody can, you know, once you're a Formula One team, these days you've got a franchise and you are participating, and you can just turn over and you can make whatever money you can make out of finishing in the midfield. And if that keeps you happy, that's great. But actually, if you have proper ambition, you need to have a structure and a leadership that's going to deliver something. And I don't see many of the team principals as true leaders of the complex organizations that modern Formula One teams are. Final thing I'll say on this and then hand over to Matt is I feel for Mattia Binotto and Jos Capito also on a personal level, because I know what it's like to one moment be working at the sharp end in Formula One and the next moment to be completely out of the paddock. And if you put as much personal energy and effort and career investment into it, it's quite a gutting experience when that happens. I mean, and I know from having interviewed Jos Capito for the magazine at the beginning of last year, how much he was absolutely relishing the Williams role And here he is now out of that role. So I'm sure he'll, you know, happily move into retirement or maybe move on to something else. But I'm sure he'll be bitterly disappointed with what's occurred there. And I'm sure for Mattia Binotto, probably can't quite believe what, you know, where he's at now. So from a personal point of view, those two gentlemen will be undoubtedly feeling very disappointed at the moment. But for those who are being moved into the new positions, Andrea Stella, I'm sure incredible achievement for him to end up as team principal, ultimately reporting to Zach and the leadership at McLaren. I think for Fred Vasseur, I mean, we all remember what he did in junior formula. He was the team to beat when I owned Status Grand Prix. I mean, there was basically ART were the benchmark. We did everything we could to recruit people who'd worked there, engineers, mechanics, to learn what the magic formula was at his team. You know, Fred did an amazing job in junior formula. And then Andrea Seidel, you know, going back to Sauber, brackets Audi, isn't really that much of a surprise. You know, he's been there before, you know, with the Volkswagen Audi organization. So that's not too much of a surprise. But these are all interesting moves, and the implications of this will be seen in the first few months of next year, because when you have big changes of leadership, people tend to bring their own lieutenants with them and change the structure a little bit, move things around. So it'll take a while for it all to settle down. And as I say, the Mercedes and the Red Bulls of this world will be enjoying the stability that they have in the face of all of this.
I'll try not to jump around, because I've got a few points to make, but I don't think there's other way of reading it than saying McLaren is the biggest loser out of this. Now, I have to caveat that by saying I don't know Andrea Stella. He's as I understand it, and media duties aren't his favourite task, and so that's something he'll have to sort of suck up and deal with as team principal. But we've gone past an age where team principals are investors in the teams, and that means if they're doing a bad job, they can easily be flicked. But it also means if they're doing a good job, they can easily be poached, because they're not ingrained in the team. And I think you look at Seidel, and I've just seen some quotes from Zach Brown. He's done his first sort of media roundtable following this news, saying we're so happy we've got our number one appointment in Andrea. But losing Seidel is a massive blow. He's the person that led the restructure, which only in 2022 has had its anything like its first stumble with the drop back in being competitive. He's led to that reorganisation that will bear fruit with a new wind tunnel, a new sim, new driver in the loop systems. And it was also his call that flicked Daniel Ricciardo and hired Oscar Piastri. Now, that means next season, the person who orchestrated those isn't there to sort of oversee the charge. And it also puts me in mind, and I mean this seriously, it puts me in mind a bit of Ford versus Ferrari, Le Mans 66, where if you wind back, so financial ringer that COVID put McLaren through, where they're taking investors. One of the principal sort of people leading the bids to take over was Audi. And McLaren said no, part because one of the risks is that the McLaren name would disappear altogether. And now it seems that Audi have, right, well, we can't get what we want, which is a takeover. So we're going to come into F1. We're going to steal your team, boss. We're going to be more competitive than you in double quick time. And seriously, they have to make a statement signing, don't they? It's not going to be Valtteri Bottas and Zhou Guanyu forever. Who is the obvious candidate that you can prize away from a long-term contract? Arguably, if Vasseur stops Leclerc from, or limits how disenfranchised Leclerc might become with unreliability. It's Lando Norris, surely. So are Audi going to end up with the team principal and the driver from the team they tried to buy as a sort of middle-fingered salute to what went wrong? But I have to say, out of all of that, Seidel is a brilliant operator. The one bit I'm slightly surprised at is at McLaren, they do like a breakfast for journalists on the Saturday of each race event. And we did this at Spa, and I spoke to Andreas following the Audi announcement they were coming in. And they did the press conference at Spa, which was fronted by the chairman and the chief technical officer of Audi. And Andreas went, ooh, I'm not sure about that one. Why is they're not a de facto team principal front and centre for Audi? I know this is only the announcement of the engine programme at the minute, but so, you know, I don't like it when it's bigwig sort of taking all the credit and front and center, because when I did the Porsche 919 program, I said, you can give us the stickers and the Porsche and the Porsche headed sort of notepaper, whatever, but we are totally separate to you. You write us the big checks. We are our own like skunk works, you know, operating after hours, whatever, and we will bring you the performance. Obviously, we don't quite know yet about timelines and where things are overlap, but if he was having those thoughts, you know, around Spa time, it's obviously between then and the end of the season. Frank, Zach Brown has said he knew Andrea Seidel was leaving before Abu Dhabi. So in that sort of pool of what's that sort of 6 to 8 races, Seidel has decided either the money's so big or going back to Switzerland or whatever is lured him away. But obviously in contrast to what he was saying earlier, unless he was just playing all the media for fools, which for someone as intelligent and articulate as Andrea Seidel was eminently possible, amongst the restructure and everything, that's all fallen under his watch, because Zach Brown was one of those bosses intelligent enough to appreciate that, you know, in this instance I need to delegate, and Seidel was that high. I can't see how they're anything but the biggest loser, even if Williams haven't got someone directly lined up that we know of, perhaps they have, and even if Andrea Stella turns out to be a fantastic team principal, and that's, you know, absolutely possible, but in the first instance you look, go, they have hired, and I sorry to jump around, but okay, Fred Vasseur is a logical hire for Ferrari, and we don't quite know what talks have him, but Seidel has got to be, if you could think Wolf is an investor and in Mercedes and Horner is wedded to Red Bull, you've got to think that Seidel would be the number one choice. Now, whether they went for Vasseur because of his links to Leclerc or whatever, or whether they approached Seidel and Seidel thinks, well, Ferrari's a bit of a basket case, I'm better off here, or whatever the timeline, the overlap is, that's a huge, huge coup for the Sauber group. And shows what hot property Andrea Seidel was, and McLaren have lost that now.
You know, he was responsible, as you say, for so much transformation in terms of getting infrastructure stuff signed off that had lain fallow. I mean, the driver in the loop simulator, which McLaren was still trying to flog off as a service through Applied Technologies, even though it was very, very far from state of the art. And he recognised that and had it got rid of and ripped up and a new one built, or is in the progress of being built. Ditto the wind tunnel that they'd effectively abandoned, and were using the Toyota wind tunnel in Cologne because it was kind of good enough. To actually, he must have put in an awful lot of energy and persuasiveness into getting the various shareholders to put the money in to basically tear out the heart of the building. The wind tunnel was the first bit of that structure put in place before the foundations of the rest of the building. So building a new one is not the work of a moment. And he recognised it needed to be done and made it happen. Will other people be able to do that?
Yeah, it's a really good point that you make. I think that was an early takeaway from Seidel's appointment, was that he had the gravitas to go in and say, this is what we have to do to be competitive. And quite frankly, tell McLaren some home truths, which helped McLaren to move away from that slightly hubristic era that they'd been stuck in, where they thought they were the best, but actually weren't, patently weren't. And has done a great job there. And I completely echo what Matt has so eloquently put in it. Seidel moving to Sauber / Audi is a massive win for that program and a massive loss for McLaren. And you know, Andrea Stella, very experienced guy. Again, the big question is, when you get a role like this, does he have what it takes to go in and, if necessary, bang the table and say, this is what we need to do in order to make the steps? And your point, Matt, about Lando Norris, absolutely bang on. There will be boredom creep in to the Norris family and entourage, by which I mean management. Lando is not there to drive for a team finishing fourth or fifth in the championship. He wants to go for wins. He wants to go for a championship. His father is extremely ambitious for him. I only mention his father because, you know, obviously he's been pivotal in Lando's career, and he's himself a highly successful, hard-nosed businessman. And you can just imagine the phone calls, the WhatsApp messages, the text messages between Andreas and Lando, the relationship that will be there. It's just, if there is a queue forming to go and drive for Audi, I would imagine Lando Norris will be quite close to the front of it. And I think Andreas will be dragging him towards the front of him to get him in there. Because think about the experience that he will have had by that stage. He'd be absolutely in his prime and ready to hopefully deliver if Audi can give him a sufficiently good enough weapon to go with. So it's it is a very exciting, very strategic move, that one. Let's see what happens elsewhere. The Williams thing is fascinating. I think I just said to you before the we start press the record button on this, there's been a change in directorships at McLaren at Williams as well, with Darren Schultz, who's the chief executive of Doralton Capital, the owners of Williams. He has resigned as a director of Williams. So there are now only three directors of Williams Grand Prix Engineering. So there's Matthew Savage from Doralton Capital. There's James Matthews, who a certain age of listener will remember was an extremely handy driver in Formula Renault, held a major record for a long time. James Matthews, it doesn't work for Doralton Capital. He has had his own investment firm in London. And then Mark Biddle. And Mark Biddle is the team's own chief legal counsel. So those are the only three directors of Williams Grand Prix Engineering. It feels to me like there's a seismic happening there. And it'll be interesting to see what emerges over the coming weeks. You would think, wouldn't you, that Jost and FX, the chief technical officer, have not left with a vacuum. There must be a plan, because if there isn't a plan, that's a massive concern.
I noted with interest, you know, the recent removal of the England rugby coach Eddie Jones with no clear successor, and you kind of think, okay, well, you know, you send the person on, what you instantly give is an advantage in the negotiation to whoever you want to fill that position or whoever they're currently employed by. We'll see how the pieces fall into place. They may even have been resolved by the time we click end on this podcast. May even be resolved by the time this podcast is published. It may even wait until the new year after we've discovered that equally vexed piece of information. Who will be the Christmas UK number one? Will it be Stormzy? Will it be Sir Cliff? Will it be Lad Baby? Equally seismic and momentous news yet to come in the following weeks. While some of us are thinking it's time to roll down the shutters for another year, uncork the port and sit down by a roaring fire, if you're lucky enough to have one, the current issue of GP Racing carries the cover date of January 2023. We have already sung Auld Lang Syne. We've already consigned Sir Cliff's greatest hits to the bin again. We've packed up the Christmas decorations. We've welched on the gym membership. February 2023 is up next. We hope we'll have discovered the identity of the people that will be filling these vacancies before then. In the interim, it's time for us to bring this podcast to a conclusion, for me to thank my guests, Matt Q, the recent, and wish him all the best for this trip to the frozen north to recover his chattels from the corrupt landlord.
Thank you very much, Collins. I appreciate that. And I think there'll be a direct relation between my family's happiness with their Christmas presents and how much of a deposit we get back for the house. So I can report back in the new year.
Let's hope that Mark Gallagher's wine store thaws out before our next podcast.
Yes, well, I have to say it's been it's weird, isn't it? Saying we're off for Christmas and the new year. I have to say Christmas Down Under leaves a lot to be desired. There's a chap up the road with an inflatable Santa Claus on the roof of his house. And I have to say last week in 34 degrees centigrade, it had become quite distinctly deformed in the heat. It wasn't looking particularly healthy. It was a kind of melting troll of a Santa Claus on his house. But anyway, for what it's worth, to all the listeners who put up with our ramblings, from my own personal perspective, hope you all have a great Christmas, a happy new year, and a fantastic 2023.
There is a fantastic 2023 in prospect. Well, thank you, Mark, for your contributions. Thank you all for listening. If you wish to subscribe to the print version of this podcast, the slightly less mad print magazine GP Racing, you can visit gpracing.com. Should you feel the urge when you're out shopping to add a magazine to your basket of Christmas presents, and you want to know which shop to visit that will actually have stock of our magazine that hasn't been snatched off the shelves by eager beavers already, you can go to seymour.co.uk and visit their magazine finder. That's Seymour as in one of Henry VIII's wives, perhaps even the one who survived, I forget. Anyway, we'll see you next month. Have a great Christmas and New Year, and thank you also very much to our long-suffering producer, Martin Lee.